Good morning. Welcome to another episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings. I am Brian Nemhauser, and it is a Seahawks Saturday, which can only mean one thing. Jeff Simmons is joining us from his bunker up there in Toronto. Good to see you this morning, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I can't believe, like, I had an Arizona on Wednesday. I can't believe it's on week four. Like, the season, football season goes so fast. It's crazy. Like, I remember just waiting for week one. It felt forever, and now I can't believe I'm leaving in like 3 days.
I know. It's this just relentless pace, right? Like, you go, I mean, the football week used to be Sunday, Monday night, and then, you know, one game Monday night, and then you'd wait. And now it's just one thing after the other. Like, even today, I'm kind of like, okay, so who are the Seahawks going to bring up from the practice squad, and who are they going to fill that roster spot that they just created by releasing Cody White? And who knows, man?
What's going on there with Cody White? They must have some deal with him, because they're just kind of, I feel bad for the guy. I know he's probably getting paid well, but like,
I think that's what's happening, actually. So this is not a report. I'm not saying this. I've talked to the Seahawks organization or anything like that, but just knowing what I've learned about John Schneider and that front office over the years is that they do try to take care of the guys. And so okay. I'm guessing, and I don't know all the rules, I'm guessing there's some sort of salary thing that happens when he's on the active, like on the 53 for a certain period. And then Shaq Griffin clearly is the vet that they know that they want on the roster. So he's going to get paid. Like, we know they've done stuff like this with Artie Burns in the past. Yeah. And so I'm guessing they're just trying to reward Cody White in some way, but I don't know. I don't know. I mean, he's back on the practice squad. I don't think he's going anywhere. For people that don't know what we're talking about, he was released from the 53 yesterday, signed immediately back to the practice squad. Last week, he was on the 53, released. Shaquille Griffin was signed to the 53, and then Shaquille Griffin was released, and Cody White was signed back this week, and now at least Cody White's been released. We don't know who's been signed back. Maybe Shaquille Griffin again. I don't know. I don't know, man. It's a little hard to follow. There's a lot to go over. Like, obviously we'll talk about the Saints game. Haven't had a chance to talk with you about that. And I think we'll talk a little bit about the Cardinals game as well. Although we'll be able to do a show together, maybe even with Evan next week, all in the same place. I'm looking forward to that, man. But I thought it'd be fun to kind of revisit a little bit of the Seahawks offseason so far and how we're feeling about the decisions that they made, and maybe any FOMO that we're feeling about something we wish that they had done. And I kind of wanted to start with the area that we had the most focus on, and then we can kind of broaden out. But offensive line, right? Like, offensive line was a big part of this. I actually even want to broaden out to the coaching decisions that they made on the OC and the offensive line side. But how are you feeling so far? Now that you know what you know through 2 weeks, how are you feeling about the decisions and the moves the Seahawks made for the offensive line?
I feel okay. I think Zabel's gotten a bad rap from like Pro Football Focus, and that might be impacting some of the people who really know offensive line have been pretty calm on Zabel. And you look at all the veterans that we're kind of looking at in the offseason, the Kevin Zeitlers and the Will Fries and Tevin Jenkins, and no one's really jumping off the page. I'll say the one guy, and you sent me a text last week, and he's not playing the position that we thought he'd be playing. So maybe we're wrong on that one. But Jared Wilson has gotten off to a really strong start with the Patriots. I think he's playing left guard there, if I'm correct.
He is.
And so we looked at him as a center prospect, a pure center. And Zabel's obviously playing left guard. So I don't know if he would have been able to play center or another position. That's the one I still feel a bit uneasy about. If they could have had two guys like that in the offseason, but it's not like Anthony Bradford or Sundell or any of those guys have been a real problem. I think they've been fine. But seeing him succeed, and I want him in the second round, and the fact that he went past the Jalen Milroe pick, that's made me feel a little uneasy. And if Will Fries came out and was playing great, that one would be a little harder to swallow. But he's been kind of mid, and Ryan Kelly's been banged up, which was a concern you brought up. He was a guy that I liked quite a bit. I know some guys on our show liked him. He was out last week. I don't know if he's played. I think he's ruled out again this week. And age and injury, that's a concern. So really, when you look at that list of veterans, no one's really jumped off the page. I don't know how Joe Thuney's done with the Chicago. That's an area.
We'll touch on it. We'll touch on it right now, actually. Yeah. So I'm looking right now, and we always talk, like, Pro Football Focus grades are certainly not the thing to, like, decide everything based off of, but there's not a lot of good offensive line measures out there where you can at least say, okay, these guys were measured by the same criteria. How did they do? Like, it's just, it's hard to say. So it's at least worth bringing up. And looking at Will Fries, remember the thing with Will Fries that we talked about was, besides the injury, this guy had been not that good, except he had a really good start to last year. His, like, highest PFF grade in his career before last season was 61.2. And then he had this big breakout. He was like 86.9 last year. Everyone's like, oh, he's finding his way. Had a pretty serious injury. So far, he's got a 54.7 grade. So it's not like, I mean, he's also blocking for JJ McCarthy, or has been, which is no easy task for anybody. They got another guy on their list that I was super high on, Donovan Jackson, in the draft, right? Like, I would have been, I don't know if equally happy with Jackson or Zabel, but I would have been pretty as close to equal as possible. And Jackson had a really good first game. Actually had a 74 grade, 88.1 pass block. Second game, not so good, 44.4, 38.8 pass block. So that hasn't been as great, but he's, I think he's played reasonably.
I think they're pretty happy with him down up there.
I think so too. I'm looking at how many pressures he's surrendered overall. He's allowed 4 pressures and a sack, which is not a small amount. Will Fries has allowed 5 pressures and a sack. So that's that group. And then you mentioned Chicago, right? Chicago went with the vets primarily. They brought in Joe Thuney, Drew Dahlman, and Jonah Jackson, right?
Drew Dahlman. I forgot about him.
Right?
Yeah.
So Drew Dahlman, has so far a 59.5 grade. Joe Thuney has a 59.8 grade. Like, he has never had below like a 75. Last year he was an 80. So it's not a good start for him. And then they brought in Jonah Jackson as well. Remember?
Yeah.
Right. 47.4 grade.
Ooh. So you have to wonder how much you feel.
Imagine how you feel if the Seahawks had made moves to bring in more expensive veterans and you were getting that level of performance.
That would be tough to swallow. That would be. And again, why these guys come available? When offensive linemen become available, it's usually a bit of a question mark. Mm-hmm. Offensive line are so valuable in the league. You saw what even the Niners paid Colton McKivitz, who's been below average right tackle. There's usually a question, either an age question, an injury question. There's not a lot of quality. Like, when Joe Thuney hit free agency the first time, that was New England screwing up. They should have signed him. But now you do wonder, are some of these guys damaged goods? And do we get excited about some of these guys that aren't that good? And which is why a lot of coaches and a lot of general managers would try to go through the draft, because quality offensive line don't tend to hit free agency. And again, I wonder how much is Chicago and just how things are going on there and how it's being coached. And you look at Indianapolis, for example, they've dropped in Tanner Bordellini and whoever's playing right, Matt Gonzalez, a right guard, and they're not missing a beat. They're one of the best offensive lines in the league. And you take Fries and Kelly out of there, and sometimes these systems can hide guys. And you look at some of the guys, like even in New Orleans, I was looking at some of the numbers with and without John Benton. And some of the guys have taken pretty significant drop-offs. And so coaching, and this is what John Schneider talked about, and we all kind of laughed at him, the coaching and the systems, they really matter. And it's very easy to get excited about these veteran guys. And still, I would have been very into, but I spent so much energy on Drew Dahlman and the mental energy on how he can unlock everything. And before he even brought his name up, I forgot about him. And things have not gone well in Chicago. They have a pretty high-paid, high-level coaching staff, but things have not come together quickly for them.
Yeah. And I mean, you kind of think about it, Jeff, and maybe, I mean, I think it would have made us feel better to have a veteran where you feel like, okay, the floor is not going to be so low.
Yeah.
But the Seahawks, everything I know in talking with people in that organization is John Benton did not want the old guys. He wanted like someone younger. Now they looked at Will Fries, but, and they were going to sign that guy. I'm not sure I'd feel better about Will Fries and his price tag and his injury history and his performance level over what the Seahawks have now. Like, I don't know that I'd feel better about it.
And that's where free agency gets so tough, because I think a lot of teams came to the same evaluation that the market was pretty thin. This was the one guy worth betting on. And this guy who's been up, had pretty much five good games in 4 years, was worth investing this much money in. The bidding war between the Vikings, I think the Cardinals were involved. And for a guy like this, who's a 59 graded player, whatever the number was, it's kind of crazy in hindsight. And so, yeah, they have not outperformed Anthony Bradford at right guard, which is kind of crazy to say. I would have, if you had told me that in March, I would have laughed. I would have laughed in your face. And I haven't noticed Anthony Bradford. I know sometimes he shows up in clips, but last year you noticed him because of the penalties. You noticed him because of the whiffs. I don't know if he has a penalty. I don't want to jinx it, but I don't know if he has a penalty yet this year. And he's been relatively fine. And I think there's some things he's done relatively well. So cost value in terms of coaching, they've actually come out okay in a situation I imagine they felt pretty bad about at the time.
You teed me up perfectly, Jeff. So it's funny. I'm going to share a number for you in a second, because I have the information about penalties with Anthony Bradford and beyond. But just looking for right now, for whatever it is, through 2 weeks, Anthony Bradford is the 14th highest graded guard in the NFL. He is the highest graded Seahawks guard.
Yeah.
He is right there with Matt Gonsalves from the Colts. He's above Robert Hunt of Carolina, above Trey Smith of Kansas City.
He's above Trey Smith.
He's above Trey Smith and Cody Mauch and Damian Lewis. So, I mean, this is not, again, PFF grades are not decisive.
Yeah.
But they've also, let's be honest, Anthony Bradford's PFF grade last year was 48.3. And the year before that was 51.7. And I don't think we would have had a bit of concern about those grades, right? Like, those are pretty accurate. He was not very good. So I don't think we can completely dismiss it when all of a sudden his grade goes up. But part of what goes into these grades, Jeff, is penalties. And I was curious looking at this today, because the Seahawks have the fewest penalty yards of any team in the NFL so far through 2 weeks. I was like, I don't remember the offensive line really having a problem. Well, so far, they are one of only two offensive lines in the NFL that have zero holding penalties and zero false starts. Zero. And not only that, Jeff, but if you look back to last year, the Seahawks were fourth in the NFL in false start penalties, not somewhere you want to be. And they were fifth in the NFL in offensive holding penalties. So you're going from one of the most penalized offensive lines that was leading to a lot of first and 15s, first and 20s, or second and 15s and second and 18s or whatever, to even why this offense is starting to get going, not being held back by their own mistakes. Now, it's only 2 weeks, but I think that that's pretty important if they can sustain that kind of discipline.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the sample size is small. So it's been 2 weeks. We might look ridiculous in a month or 2 months for bringing this up ever. But I think it just goes along the lines with what Dennison and Kubiak and Benton, that's what they were kind of told we were. The Saints writers talked about how quickly they installed their offense, how quickly they installed their coaching. And you've kind of talked about how so many of those offensive linemen had better performances. And I've heard Mike McDonald talk about their operation a lot and how clean their operation has been and how he's happy with that. they've had some a lot of plays where they've lost the run blocking on early downs and they've been second and nines and things like that. We saw Charbonnet's production last week. It wasn't particularly good. But in terms of like the pure operation and how that can set you back, and I've definitely noticed how much cleaner they've been just in terms of how they're playing, how they're coached. Obviously, last year was probably one of the worst examples, and just felt like the last 7-8 years of the Pete Carroll era was just a lot of that same. It wasn't just the underwhelming players. It was the amount of time they were taking silly penalties, how undisciplined they were, how they weren't working in conjunction together. It was not a fun watch. And you watched Houston the other night, or you watched the Raiders the other night, and you're like, oh my God, this looks so familiar. And I think you tweeted out during the Texans game, this is like PTSD for a Seahawks fan. We've seen all that stuff, the snap penalties. And I think it goes to the coaching staff and then goes to Mike that the fact is they're that low in penalties across the board. Because Pete didn't seem to care about that as long as the other areas, their high performance levels were good. He would live with this stuff. This is a much more buttoned up operation, and it's good to see early returns on that.
So I know Jeff echoes this a little bit. Johnny A says, why does anyone care about PFF? And I get it. I get it. I'm going to reiterate like why I bring this up, because I think it's a little bit selective when people decide it's no longer relevant. If I was to tell you the top graded PFF guards from last year were Chris Lindstrom, Quinn Meinerz, Kevin Zeitler, Quentin Nelson, Dominic Pooney, Joe Tooney, Landon Dickerson, Kevin Donson, Elijah Vera Tucker, John Simpson, Damian Lewis, Tevin Jenkins, Trey Smith, Tyler Smith, Cody Mauch, Matt Bergeron. Does any of that sound like, oh, they completely don't know what they're doing? They're way off. Those are the best guards in football. So I get why people are like individual PFF grades. They're like, this is way off, or I don't get this, or this is they've totally missed, or that there's some positions where they really are way off. I get it. But if you look at who ends up at the top and often at the bottom of those lists, it passed the sniff test. Like, and it is an objective, equally applied set of criteria. Whether it's a good set of criteria, that's totally debatable. But I think in absence of like, okay, let's watch every all 22 snap of every offensive lineman ourselves and come up with our own grades, I do think it's directionally relevant, like that Anthony Bradford is grading better than he did last year. I think it's got to sustain, but I think it's relevant.
Yeah, I think there's certain positions where it's proven over time that they're pretty good at it. And I think Josh brought this up to me this week, that offensive line and defensive line historically have been really well graded by them. And you just read out the numbers. Linebacker and safety has been a weakness of theirs because of just how unique their responsibilities are and how do you grade those. Like for years, they just graded Earl Thomas and it was perplexing when he was definitely the best safety in the league. And Ernest Jones, the way they've graded him relative to like Tyrell Dodson a couple of years ago. And that just
even this year, he's still a PFF.
Yeah, they don't seem to understand that position well, or their criteria is just off based on coverage linebackers and things like that. But I will say offensive and defensive lines historically, I've looked. It is a much better, a much more proven. I think it's much easier to measure. Again, I mentioned I didn't agree with how kind of how low Zabel's been. I don't think Zabel's been like a 80-level player or anything like that, but he's still had one pressure, I think, in the season so far, and he's had some good moments. So I think he's been a little bit better. I've seen Baldy really do Baldy, who was an offensive lineman himself, is really focused on him. But I think we can, as someone who is critical of them and does question a lot of what they do, I was certainly irked by how they graded the Seahawks defense last week when they dominated the game and only four guys were over 70. It made no sense to me. But yeah. I think Brian is right. I will say, as someone who does get irked by them, I think when you look at like the full sample size, things tend to even out and the cream does seem to rise to the top with their grades. And again, when you do look at it at the end of the year, it's not like it's always Lane Johnson and Creed Humphrey and those guys at the top. And
well, and it's not just them. Like, speaking of trying to get a fix on what's going on with the offensive line, if you look at our good pal, Ben Baldwin, and he does his offensive line composite ratings through week two, Seahawks there are 21st, which is pretty good.
Big jump.
But it's a composite, which means, Jeff, it's bringing a few things together. So PFF, it has, I don't know how this 40 out of 100, SIS has it 80 out of 100. ESPN's pass block win rate, Jeff, has the Seahawks as the worst offensive line in football. I find it very frustrating. 33rd team has their own offensive line metrics. They've got the Seahawks around 24th. And this composite grades has the 49ers as the third best offensive line in the league. And I thought the Seahawks dominated that offensive line for the most part. Most pressure Brock Purdy's ever been under. So I don't know. Like you can't take any one metric or any one group and just say that they've figured it out. But we talk about Mekhi Becton. I talked about James Daniels, who's already hurt again.
Already injured, yeah.
I kind of look through this, Jeff, and the move that maybe the one that I probably feel the most FOMO about is Connor Colby.
I liked him.
I know Rob and I all were like, this guy was a good zone blocking guard. Like, are we sure he's not worth a flyer in the late rounds? San Francisco takes him in the seventh round. He's played pretty well so far.
He did. He stepped in for Ben Burks last week against the defensive line we're seeing tomorrow. So I'm curious to see whether that's a Colby thing, whether that's a Saints thing. You always got to account for the opponent. But yeah, well, when Rob first brought up Connor Colby to me, it was because of his zone blocking skills. And I think he was from one of the schools that ran a lot of zone blocking. He really stood out. And the Seahawks took Bryce Cabledew a round earlier. We'll see how that one plays out. And if San Francisco gets a good replacement for Aaron Banks in the seventh round, that's going to be very irritating, because that was a guy who fit our scheme. We're running the same offensive line scheme perfectly. And for me, it's Jared Wilson. Knowing that he can play center, right guard, and he can play guard. He's playing guard at a high level. And they had three chances to get him. I would have been comfortable taking him before they traded up for him and Worry. I don't know what Tate Radledge has done. I know Detroit did a little better last week than they did in the opening week. But he's a guy we had my eye on. Yeah, Mekhi Becton I really liked before they hired Clint Kubiak. Once they hired Clint Kubiak, I said Becton's done. Yeah. So when we thought they were going to hire maybe Hank Fraley or that kid who ended up from – I don't even remember that guy from Minnesota, the whiz kid from Minnesota. I didn't know what kind of offensive line they were going to run. So once Becton went to a very powerful team and the Chargers, that one never really fit once they brought in the zone guys. And Tyler Booker apparently has done pretty well in Dallas.
He's given up six pressures through two games.
Yeah, I don't like the offensive line people really like him, but we never passed. It's not like we passed on him anyway. So he's kind of irrelevant to us. He would have never got to Seattle, and he didn't really fit the zone blocking system. So I think we'd all be pretty happy to take Zabel again.
Yeah, I don't have any regrets about the Zabel thing. He's given up five pressures for what it's worth. No sacks, but he did give up a few hits. And like, look, what I see with Gray Zabel is he is still acclimating. He's not at his best. And at the same time, I see all the attributes physically and just professionally that he's going to be a great player. I think we're not going to regret that pick, but he has had some really rough reps, man. Like if you look at the touchdown pass to Torrey Horton,
yeah,
he gets blown up on that play, flat backed on that play. And I think that happened a few times.
And yeah, I think the thing that's been impressive with him, it's just basically he went through all of camp as a small school guy who's making a big jump up in competition and just seamlessly fit in. And you see so many rookies, and we've seen it with the Seahawks over the years where their first round picks are just like a roller coaster. And with him, it's like he just went in, became the starter. You never heard his name. Everybody loved him. He's playing the games. He's had some rough moments coming from a small school, like Grant Barden did and Cody March did. Same kind of thing. And he's taken his lumps, but overall he's fit in pretty well. You haven't noticed him like jump off the screen as someone who's struggling. And I actually thought there'd be moments where he would just whiff, and like maybe you have to look a little deeper, watch the All-22. But again, I think he's acclimated really, really well. And I think that's really encouraging for a lot of these rookie offensive linemen take off in the second half of the season. That's been the trend. Like you saw with Grant Barden last year, it was a real struggle at first. Second half of the year, he looked like one of the best centers in the league. And then I don't know if Zabel will look like one of the best guards in the league, but I think he projects really, really well.
Well, so offensive line sounds like we feel pretty good about and what they've done there. Not a lot. Like, I give it a pretty good grade so far relative to all the other scenarios they could have followed. And then you look at what would be the next position group you think about. Like, mine kind of goes to what's the next highest draft pick they spent. It was on safety, right? And there are, there's a little FOMO there, right?
This weekend, especially with Love and even Worry out, that one's going to hurt a bit.
Well, and you look at some of the players out there, Andrew Mukuba for the Eagles has been playing excellent football. There's been some other safeties that I think have played pretty well this year, but we haven't had a chance. Like, the only plays that Nicky Minwori was in on, he got a tackle for loss.
He played three snaps and he looked pretty good.
For all we know, he's better than everybody, but it is a little hard because we haven't had a chance to see him.
Yeah, the FOMO is definitely real, especially this week with Minwori and Love out. And then next man up is all of a sudden Ty Okada or DeAnthony Bell. And it's a pretty big drop off. And yeah, I know Nathan from our show and Maddie Browns, I think, were very high on Andrew Mukuba. And they thought he was a better player than Minwori. And I think that trade up and trade really kind of irked those guys. And seeing Makuba's really flashed in Philadelphia, where not a lot of guys have flashed on that defense so far. They've kind of taken a step back, but he made a ton of plays in both games. And had they not traded up and they took Mukuba, they could have gotten an extra third round pick, which maybe that's Jared Wilson. You could have got Jared Wilson and Mukuba for Minwori. So Minwori's got a big, obviously he's had a bad, terrible luck. He gets injured in the first drive of the season. He was playing a huge role. He looked really good and we didn't get to see him. And so, yeah, it's hard not to have FOMO seeing some of these other safeties flash around the league. And we traded two premier picks to get this guy. And he's a key part of what they were going to do. And now with Love out, who may be their best player other than Leonard Williams on defense. Yeah, we're really tested this weekend.
Yeah, a couple other just rookie updates there. We will see Jonas Sanker, who was drafted in the third round by the Saints. He actually he is now starting because the safety that they had brought in is injured. So Justin Blackmon, he played pretty well against San Francisco, at least by PFF measures. He had a 70 grade. Xavier Watts for the Falcons was drafted in the third round out of Notre Dame. He's been really good as well. He's the top graded safety by PFF. Now, to your point, PFF and their safety grades, who knows? Another guy, Marcus Siegel, who had, it was the only athletic profile even close to Nicky Minwori. He's played pretty well for San Francisco, although PFF doesn't like him. He's got a 46.9 grade. I've liked what I've seen from him, so I don't throw it out entirely. But man, I don't know about you, Jeff. Just even seeing Nicky Minwori back with a jersey on yesterday and out there with Devin Witherspoon on the practice field, I just want to see this guy out there, man.
Yeah, he was a huge part of their offseason. They almost took him a pick. If Gray Zabel was gone, they were going to take him in the first round. And so they had a huge grade, and the whole idea was what could he do with Mike McDonald? And he was an athletic freak, and there's just so many exciting things about him. And what they could do in Big Nickel, and they could have him around the line and just have that body type with all the good things they have going on defense. Again, they're kind of those blue chip players away from being a top five, borderline top five defense to a great defense. And he projected as someone who had that skill set. Again, he was a flawed player and there's a reason he slipped out of the first round, but my God, yeah, it's going to be so much fun to see him play. I don't know how much they're going to have to ease him in now, but they just don't have guys like that. Just don't come around very often. There's Kyle Hamilton. There's Sean Taylor. Like, I don't know how many guys built like that who can run like that with this kind of coaching. My God, it's so exciting.
I'm definitely not going to get too worried until, you know, we've had a full, probably into next season with Nicky Minwori. Yeah. I think if you give the veterans a full season to get acclimated to this defense, I think you got to be reasonable about bringing a rookie along. Who knows? Hopefully he flashes early.
Well, look at Earl and Cam. Earl and Cam are maybe the two best football players I've seen on the Seahawks. Earl was a disaster as a rookie. I love Earl. Maybe my favorite player I've watched. And he was a mess. Pete almost benched him. And Cam Chancellor literally sat on the bench and was a special teams dime player his entire first year. And we're seeing Byron Murphy a little bit, the second year jump. It's early, but we're certainly seeing a lot more than we did last year. So we do have to give the guy time, but yeah, it's going to be hard not to come to conclusions quickly when you see Makuba flashing. And
all right, so let's talk one more kind of pairing of position, then we'll move on.
Yeah.
Tight end wide receiver. So this is obviously a big thing. They let Noah Fant go. We had a lot of conversations in the receiver stuff. And like, we didn't have a chance to draft Tyler Warren, so we don't have to worry about that, right? Like, would have been great, but didn't have a chance. But if you look at receivers and tight ends that are, I think, off to a decent start, I think you'd say, sorry, let me pull off the running backs here. Amika Egbuka.
Yeah,
like, is there any part of you that feels like, man, they should have drafted Egbuka instead of Gray Zabel? Because that's how high you would had to have taken him.
So not for a second. Actually, that would be a debilitating pick. And I think Ibuka's looked great.
He has.
But if you would have taken a second receiver over the left guard, and then you, I don't know who would be playing left guard right now. Might it be Christian Haynes? I don't know. Always offensive line over receiver, always. And you're seeing it with the Chargers. There's so much talk about Malik Nabers and whether they take Joe Alt, who's been incredible so far. He's kicked the left tackle. For me, look, I think Ibuka has been kind of what we said. I think he's a really good player. I think he's a really good player for someone else. And I think he's like a souped up version of Robert Woods. And I don't know if that's what makes Seattle a better team. I think an offensive lineman all day. No regrets whatsoever.
So a couple other names there. Alike Iyemunar from Stanford has played decently for the Titans, was drafted all the way in the fourth round. Harold Fannin Jr. I'm seeing people really, I haven't had a chance to watch him play for the Browns, but I'm seeing people talk about this guy like in the same breath as Brock Bowers, which I'm like, whoa,
no.
Like seriously? He's got 12 receptions for 111 yards through two games. The other guy that I'd bring up, Dante Thornton Jr., you know, that I like, he got drafted in the fourth round. I really liked him. But otherwise, I mean, do you feel like the Seahawks did okay with Elijah Arroyo and Torrey Horton?
Yes. And it's super early. Like we've seen historically receivers and tight ends. I think Bowers broke a lot of people's brains and Warren so far. Because historically, rookie tight ends have been slow, and there hasn't been many that have hit in year one. And so, like, you look, for example, Mason Taylor with the Jets. It's been really, really quiet so far. He's been banged up. Colson Loveland has two catches for 16 yards, something like that. That's it. And they took him over Warren. I think when they let Elijah Arroyo in the game plan, he looked pretty good. And again, he has – I think he's not a complete tight end. I think there's a reason he fell the second round. He's got injury questions, but – when he's in space with the ball, he looks really good. Like that play they ran was pretty smart of Kubiak last week, but he looked like a difference maker when he gets there in space. Some of the receivers they could have taken, like Ibuka, and again, Matthew Golden's been okay, but he hasn't got the stats yet. He's had some drops. I would not feel good if they had that as their first round pick. The guy in Tennessee, the Canadian guy, Ayo Manor from Stanford, people thought at the time the Seahawks were going to draft him, and they actually went one pick before them and they traded out. So I'll never know if they were actually going to take him or not. But Horton looked pretty good last week when they actually let him involved in the offense. And for a fifth round pick at a small school, he looked pretty good. So Jaden Higgins, who was a guy I was really high on, I think you were a little colder on by the end of the process, hasn't looked great. He's looked kind of reductive.
They would have had to take him in the first round because he was
He went above the Iman-Wari pick. Jalen Noll had a cool punt return. He said, when I always wonder about, I would have loved his speed counteracted with JSN. He'll be interesting to track, but they're not really using him. And Christian Kirk's coming back. Dante Thorne was a guy we thought would be a mid-day three guy. He went early in four. Like Pete, and he's looked good on a team that hasn't looked particularly good on offense, but he's flashed with those down skills. And MVS didn't even make the team, and that was the role youth figured. So maybe that could have been a third-round pick.
I mean, I liked Isaac Tesla. I didn't like him enough to draft him in the third round.
It took 2/3 to draft him.
I cannot even in retrospect say, oh, they should have taken him. I didn't see third. I thought like he'd be a great fifth round pick. Like if they had picked him instead of Torrey Horton, I would have been like, awesome. Although I really like Torrey Horton too. So, I mean, he's won. Jack Besh has played okay.
Terrence Ferguson's done nothing. He's not even getting on the field.
Yeah.
Jack Besh has struggled to get on the field.
Savion Williams, I thought, has been like an interesting player for the Packers, but I'm not.
He's a LaVisca Chenault type. He's not.
He is.
So I think this reaffirms my big take on this, that you can find receivers every year. And even if this year, if your plan was kind of take a step back at the position, kind of fill it with a Cooper Kupp, I think we've seen third rounders, fourth rounders, fifth rounders. And next year, like if they take a receiver in the first or second round, I think they can fill that spot pretty easily. So many people get hyper-focused on wide receiver, but we're seeing just in this draft even, which was not supposed to be a good receiver draft, there's first rounders, there's second rounders, there's third rounders, fourth round. So I think organizationally, they're going to be fine. It was far more important to get the line of scrimmage, the infrastructure, and you could always find a wide receiver the next year in the draft because it's just a position that's just loaded in college.
Well, I mean, Jeff, how often have we just said, like, the Seahawks are losing the line of scrimmage every year, every week, every play? And that's not the case this year. And that's because they've invested first in the defensive line with Leonard Williams and Byron Murphy and Jaron Reed, Derek Hall, Boye Mafe, DeMarcus Lawrence. Like, they invested there and you get some returns. Offensively, first round pick on Charles Cross, third round pick on Abe Lucas, you know, third round pick on Christian Haynes didn't work out, but fourth round pick on Anthony Bradford might. First round pick on Gray Zabel. And, you know, then you also invest in a fullback. And all of a sudden, it feels much more like there's a foundation to build on. And beyond that, Jeff, I even look back. We'll do one more look back and then we'll start looking forward. Think about the hiring decision to bring on Mike McDonald last year.
Yeah.
Where did they go before they went to Baltimore? Detroit. They went to interview Ben Johnson and left there. And then Ben Johnson decided to pull himself out of the running of the Patriots job, I think, before they even arrived.
It was Washington.
Washington. Thank you. Yes, yeah. Washington. So do you, like, of all the coaching decisions that the Seahawks could have made that year, do you wish it was Dan Quinn, Mike Vrabel, Ben Johnson? Is there somebody that you're like, man, they should have hired this guy over Mike McDonald?
For me, it's not even close. And look, I got to a dark place in the first half last week where they should have been up 10, 14 points and they were screwing up. And I'm like, is there something going on with this coaching? Or they just seem to screw up every, like, I can't remember the word I used, but it was just like point of like impact decision. Like every time they did it, they would screw it up. And then the second half, you saw exactly what we wanted to see from this team. And all of a sudden my kind of normal energy came back. But if you talk to me at any point in the offseason, at any point, I've been pretty high on McDonald. And I think you, who've been around him and seen the team a lot more close, I think you've had most of the same opinions and certainly some other questions that I haven't had, but I've been really high on him. You see the impact on defense just with the same players that Pete had essentially and the performance. And you're seeing the trends that he had in Baltimore show up early. But I think the things that he values, the line of scrimmage, building a team sort of like Baltimore and Michigan, when you hear like the national guys talk about the Seahawks so far, it's like, well, they have some limitations, but the one thing they're really good at has been the line of scrimmage. And from the Seahawks, that was the thing more than anything that frustrated me at the end of the Pete Carroll year. That he talked very specifically about how he wanted to coach and the teams he wanted to build. And their highest paid players were corners and safeties and receivers. And they weren't drafting line of scrimmage. And they weren't building the team they talked about. And to see this come together this quickly, where it really started with Leonard Williams and Byron Murphy. And I remember your reaction when they took Byron Murphy. I think I remember the first thing you said was, we now have the best defensive tackle group in the NFC West. I remember that for whatever reason. It looks like that's true. And that changes so much of how they play. they've kind of nickeled and dimed that position for years, and they were pretty good at it. But you see those defensive tackles, the three of them with Reed, that video that Baldy put out last week, I just thought was so emblematic of where the roster is. And it's really fun to see because that kind of play carries to the road. I think that's a big reason they're playing so well on the road over time. That kind of play, you can build, it's much easier to build wide receiver groups and skill players, and eventually they're going to have to get a franchise young quarterback in there. But the other things you can build, everything has to start from there. And then you look at all those names we talked about, I don't feel great about any of them. Dan Quinn had a great year last year. I expect him to step back a little bit. And you've seen him kind of return to some cowardly stuff in the last game. I thought he did an awesome job last year. But if there's someone, just the combination of scheme, team building, the staff they've built, I think I feel best about where they landed.
That's where I'm at. Yeah. And I just bring it up because how often do we look back and we're like, man, if they would have just, or why couldn't they have just, because we get the benefit of hindsight, right? And almost always there's going to be some more optimal decision than the one you made. It takes a little luck to not have that be the case. And so far, again, like, going to keep caveating, just 2 weeks, I don't feel a lot of regret about what the Seahawks did on almost any of the moves that they made. I will say, just on the other side, no one's shown up as a blue chip, you know, this guy is a breakout star yet. I feel encouraged by Gray Zabel, Robbie Utes, Elijah Arroyo, even Nicky Minori, who hasn't played that much, Torrey Horton, you know, on through. Like, I feel encouraged, but I can't say that, like, okay, this guy is already going to be the next Brock Bowers level rookie, or, you know, Jared Verse level rookie or something like that, has not shown up yet. So they still need that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what makes a good draft class versus a great draft class. And the New Orleans draft class in 2017, I think it was, had so many of those guys, Kamara and Trey Hendrickson and Ryan Ramczyk and all these guys that all hit at the same time. And it took them from a 7-9 team to a Super Bowl level team. And we've seen what the Rams have done with Verse and Puka and all these guys. You need to see that. And for that, they've had a lot of good draft classes. Charles Cross is starting to look like borderline blue chip. I think we've seen some moments like that block he had last week down the field looked freaking awesome. But you see Ken Walker, when he's going, he can look like a blue chip, but we haven't seen it consistently. But I was talking about benching Ken Walker after week one. So I can't say all of a sudden he's a blue chip guy. JSN may be the closest thing, but in this draft class,
yep,
you're absolutely right. They still have, it still so far looks like a good draft class. I thought it had the look of a great draft class. And again, very small sample size. We haven't seen him in Worry, who might be the highest ceiling guy in the whole thing. But for the Seahawks to get out of this 10-win ceiling kind of thing, they need that absolutely.
All right. So let's talk about how you're feeling about this team after 2 weeks. And think about last year. Last year, they started off 3-0. They were the number one defense in the NFL, but they played every backup quarterback in imaginable. There was a lot of things that were looking questionable. This year, they're 2-0. They've played Brock Purdy and lost, and Aaron Rodgers and won. How, like, what's your take on this team? What are the things you feel like you have confidence are going to, like, sustain, and where do you have questions you're still looking to get answered?
Big confidence in what I've seen from the defensive line, especially the defensive tackle group. We just talked about that. I think when you see what they're doing, their ability to take over the game, the amount of pressure that unit put on Brock Purdy is the most he's ever been pressured. I think we've seen two games where the defensive line, and without blitzing, I think it's a really big deal. We saw some graphics that you sent and Derek sent where they're leading the league in pressure rate with blitzing the least, which was the hallmark of Mike McDonald in Baltimore. That was what made him so attractive. That I've been really encouraged. Josh Jobe has been way above expectations. I was very concerned about him. I was banging the table for Jalen Ramsey. I was banging the table for Will Johnson in the draft. He's been way ahead of where I would have guessed. So I think that spot's been good. The third corner was something I was really worried about. Now I'm worried more about Rick Woolen, but he looked pretty solid last week. The run defense, really confident in that. They're one of the best run defensive units in the league last week. I talked about DeMarcus Lawrence a lot during our shows this summer. I know he hasn't graded super high, but he's looked awesome to me. He's a difference maker in run defense. The whole group has gone far better in that spot. JSN, he's shown that he could be a number one receiver so far, to example, but I was curious how he would do once the coverage shifted purely his way. The big questions I have are Clint Kubiak, Cooper Kupp, how the offensive line will hold up over the whole season. And last week we saw a lot of promising signs. Cooper Kupp looked way quicker in open field than I would have ever expected this year. I didn't mind. I think we all kind of knew what we were getting with Kupp. Like, no one was tricking themselves into we were getting the 2021 version. I thought he'd be okay. But my big question was whether he can stay healthy. But in week one, it looked pretty bad. Let's be real. Week two, he looked good. And again, I think Griff said the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. And that's probably the most fair way. But I was still shocked about the quickness he showed in the open field. And if that's a question they can hold up with Arroyo and Horton as complementary players, that's really encouraging sign. Because week one, like, I was just so left perplexed by Clint Kubiak and the strategy of that game. And then you see week two and they do exactly what they told us they were going to do. Robbie Utes has a highlight where he bowls over two guys. They run play action for a touchdown. I hated that fourth down call. That was absurd. I thought it was weird. But Sam Darnold's been better than I thought he would too. Like, the way I talked about Darnold all offseason was I kind of thought he'd be like a Jimmy G, Matt Schaub kind of guy. And he's ripped some throws in both games. And the thing with Darnold is just when he makes a bad play, it is one of the goofiest looking plays you'll ever see. So aesthetically, it looks really bad. Like, Josh in our show last week was just like, Darnold's kind of slow and it's kind of bad. And I'm like, I'm not seeing that. And a lot of people, like, when he had that second interception, which of all the people to blame, he's very low on the list, in my opinion. But when he makes a bad play, I'll say it looks so goofy. And that's the problem with him, his interceptions, the way he ended the first game. But overall, full body of work, especially in this last game, I thought his timing on third down was really good. I thought it was decisive. That throw down the field to JSN was picture perfect. Obviously, the sample size is everything, but he's been better than I would have guessed. I would have thought he was just sort of make the throws to open guys, don't screw the game up. Not with how they called the first game, but just a very vanilla style. And he's made some throws, and he's done some things like him getting away from pressure, getting the ball to Barner. Like, that was a huge play. So, again, I do still have questions. We need to see the whole sample. We'll need to see how he does against like a team like the Rams, which speeds up his timing. But I've been pretty encouraged, and I thought he was kind of the placeholder guy. I was not in these Darnold Geno wars, and I kind of understood why they pivoted to him, and I liked the decision ultimately. But his last game was really good quarterback play.
Yeah, he has definitely been better than I expected going like – from the offseason move till now, he's better than I would have expected. And even from training camp and preseason till the regular season, he's been better than I expected. And I had reasonably, like, I had modest expectations for him, and I think he's exceeded them so far. And watching Geno play, man, like, you know, I'm a Geno fan, but the decisions he made on his interceptions, the throws he's throw, like the things he's choosing to throw, like, it gave me some like PTSD a little bit of like, man, why are you making that decision, dude? Like, why are you throwing that? And I don't have, there's not a single throw where I look at Sam Darnold and I'm like, why did you throw that? Yes, his interception against Pittsburgh, the first one, you know, wasn't great, but it wasn't like, oh, what a stupid decision to make that throw. It was maybe a little late, maybe a little bit off target, but it wasn't stupid. And offensive line's been relatively what I expected. I think they've got more in them, and I think there's a reason to think that they can be better as the season goes on, as they get more time together. I think Kenneth Walker was not and then was what I expected, right? And then Clint Kubiak was not and then was what I expected.
Yep.
And defensively, I think the only position group where I'm like, I don't know yet, because it is edge, because
yeah,
they have zero sacks. They have some pressures. Boye Mafe is putting up some advanced numbers. His like quick pressure rate, his overall pressure rate is like way up there, dude.
Yeah.
But he's got nothing to show for it so far. And Derek Hall, I watched the games and that guy shows up every freaking game. So am I I'm like a little disappointed that they're not like flashing in that way, like dominating, but it's, there's some signs there that maybe they will. Like, how do you feel about the edge group?
Pretty much how I thought of it going into the offseason. I think they're good, but not great. And look, pressures are more predictive than sacks. I think that's been proven over time. But at some point, you want to see sacks. Yes. And Brock Purdy rolls out to make the play at the end of the game. And had they sacked him, they won't have to worry about Tariq Woolen screwing up in the end zone. So I heard Mike Salk say the same thing on radio after week one. Like, yeah, they pressured him a lot, but you need to sack the guy. The best edge rushers in the league are sacking guys all the time. So, yes, Boye's numbers and the highlight Brady put out of him, like, that's a high, high-level play. But I don't think anyone would come out and say this is, like, a great-looking edge group so far. The best part of the D-line group is the interior by far. Leonard Williams is their best player, and Murphy really flashed in the first game. And last week, I think he had his best game as a Seahawk. But the edge group, again, I still think it's good, not great. Lawrence is more of a run defender than a pass rusher at this point. Nwosu looked pretty looked like a guy who hasn't played in a long time. He looked kind of stiff and jumped offside and don't know what he has left in the tank. Still have questions there. I still think they're one of those elite pass rushers away. And again, it's hard not to see what's going on in Green Bay where they do have a great edge rusher now. And what's that done for that whole defense, which has been mostly mediocre, and you drop him in there, all of a sudden Rashawn Gary, who's kind of in the Boye Mafe, Derek Hall category, is flashing. And all of a sudden you see Byron Young getting three sacks because of all the help he's getting around him. This stuff matters. So I think the edge group is pretty much what I thought, that they're fine. I was hoping like the McDonald scheme could really elevate that group. And we have seen them be fine, but I haven't seen what we've seen in Baltimore yet. And maybe that was more Clowney's profile than anything else. It doesn't seem like they're like tricking quarterbacks or disrupting their timing, kind of like they did, but they're playing well. Like Derek Hall is a physical specimen. You see him impact every game, but I don't think he's near like a Pro Bowl level anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, and that's the, like, I am holding out hope that one of those two guys can reach that level. I don't think the door's not closed on that for me. No. I think that like Nick Benito was not, and then he became, I don't believe that these guys aren't capable of making that jump yet, but like this week's pretty important because
that's what I was going to say.
These are not like the tackles that they're going to face this week. Pretty questionable. We don't know if Fuaga is going to play. And I mean, if they don't play, you're talking about, let's see, it's Asim Richards would be their right tackle. He's a swing tackle they got from the Cowboys after the cut down. He was cut from the Cowboys. Like that would be their tackle. So, and then Kelvin Banks has been okay, but his first road game, like I think the edge guy's got to eat this week, man.
I think this is the number one thing I want to see this week. And Fuaga, even if he does play, he's got a back injury. He's not been himself to start the year and a knee injury. So even if he does play, he's playing it. He's really pushing himself to go. He's not going to be himself, and he hasn't been so far. You saw like what Mykal Williams did. He took over the game a little bit last week after being at zero against the Seahawks. And it's not a good offensive line. And so I tend to hate games like this because you can't learn a lot. And if they lose, everyone thinks your team sucks. And if they win, you're like, well, they just did what they're supposed to do. But I think the thing I really want to see is the defensive line take over the game. And I especially think the edge rush group. I think for me to feel great about the Seahawks, they need to look like a just dominant defense where Spen Raster just looks over his head playing in Seattle like it used to look back in the day where young quarterbacks were just a nightmare here. And we've stopped seeing that. And some of that has to do with the pass rushers they've had. They don't have guys. When they had Bennett and Averill, when they used to do to teams, it was amazing. Even the old days with like Grant Wistrom, they were able to do that. So I think this is a huge game for that group, especially with the secondary as battered as they are. You're out three of your five best guys. And so for them to win the game, and especially to win easily, they need this group to be a huge factor. And if it's not, it might be one of those games that's a little hairy. Like everyone just assumes it's going to be a breeze because the Saints have spent a rattler, but they've been playing close with everyone so far.
Yeah, I 100% agree, man. And I also agree with this notion that of all the groups that need to dominate and like make sure that Seahawks win, the pass rush is number one on that list and defensive line overall, because look, Saints aren't stupid. They know that Alvin Kamara is going to have to be a big part of their game plan in this one, whether catching or running with the football. And the Seahawks have to be able to slow him down, because you're right. When the Seahawks have dominated at home, it's been this overwhelming defense that has been the key to those kinds of comfortable wins.
Yeah.
And as good as the defense has been, and it's been really good, Jeff, but it hasn't been overwhelming. Like, it hasn't been, man, the offense can't even operate for the opposing team. And so I'd like to see, like, because the Saints by themselves, if you give them a chance, they're gonna do some things offensively. I think even with this offensive line, I think their receivers, their tight end, their running back, their quarterback, I think they're capable of moving the ball on most defenses.
Yeah, I was really hoping these guys would just be a total pushover when I saw their roster. And I thought they'd be one of the worst teams in the league. And look, they haven't played great opponents. They played San Francisco's backups with Mac Jones. And then they played Arizona, who to me has looked pretty meh. And they've hung around. Spencer Rattler, according to a lot of these advanced sites and the film watchers, they've all liked him. And they're skilled players. The receivers are pretty good. Olave has had some injury histories, but Olave, Shaheed, Juwan Johnson's played really, really well. And it's not as easy as a game as I would have hoped. They've been playing well. So with their secondary concerns, and what Kamara, a lot of Seahawks fans have PTSD with Kamara, where he's just come in there and dominated some of those Pete Carroll defenses by the end. And it was pretty ugly. There was one game with Teddy Bridgewater where he was just dumping it off the whole game and they couldn't stop it. And it was so irritating. That was where things started to turn with Pete Carroll on his defenses. But yeah, they're going to need to play good defense. And with those secondary, and they're going to test those guys. It might not matter if the pass protection can't hold for New Orleans, but for that to happen, you need that defensive line to win the game.
So there's a couple other games I'm curious about this weekend. I want to talk to you about. I know you have a few more minutes or.
Yeah, no, I'm good with time.
Okay. So the Cardinals go into San Francisco, and the last time the Cardinals are favored in this game. Did you know that?
I looked this morning. I was shocked.
1.5, I think. The last time the Cardinals were favored in San Francisco was Kyle Shanahan's first year, 2017.
Wow.
And I was shocked, honestly. Like, maybe it's a Mac Jones thing. I don't know. But like, Mac Jones threw 3 touchdowns against the Saints last week. They almost operated more cleanly than they did when they went up against the Seahawks. So that game, and then Philadelphia against the Rams. I think the Rams are going to win this game. My biggest question mark there, obviously the run defense, but losing Akella Witherspoon, I'm kind of thinking like AJ Brown might have a big game. This one, if they can get him up against Emmanuel Forbes, talk about a physical mismatch. That would be crazy.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Matt Stafford's played really, really well to start the year. And I was kind of riding that back injury thing pretty good. And I know Pro Football Focus is number one passer, but just the eye test, he's making some throws that doesn't look like he's a guy who was coming off injury all summer. I still am left. The Eagles have been a really hard watch. They've been boring.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They're not as good.
Doesn't exist. They're clearly not as good. They're not dominating the line of scrimmage like the last 2 years, where Dallas should have beat them. And if not for all those tush pushes that were probably offside, they might have lost to a pretty depleted Chiefs team. And so the Rams, who, again, haven't played great teams, but they're playing better. But I still do wonder about that run defense against Saquon Barkley and that offensive line when they're going. So I need to see the Rams be able to stop the run against a good team. I haven't seen it. Last year, the Eagles bullied them at the line of scrimmage. It was like Saquon was like 280 in the first game, and he won the playoff game essentially because he had broke out that run in the snow. But the Rams can certainly pull off the upset. Like, the way they can play the passing game, I think the Eagles have some limitations at corner. Dory Jackson's had a really rough start to the year.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When Jalen Carter isn't going, like, they don't have the defensive line group. They have to sign Za'Darius Smith off the street. They're limited out there. Like, Nolan Smith, when he's on his own, is not that good. So they're not dominating the trenches like they did last year. And the receivers have been almost non-existent. Jalen Hurts is like barely throwing a pass over 10 yards.
I think he has 3.
It's been a hard watch.
It's 5. Yeah, something like
that. Until the Rams stop the run, I'm going to pick the Eagles, but I don't feel good about it. And I think the Rams have, you saw what they did to them in the playoffs. I think the Rams have a very good chance to win tomorrow. And I don't like saying that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really curious about that one. And I mean, let's take a quick look here at the sleeper app and what's gone on with those games. So if you go to, let's go to the Rams Eagles game, and they've got, let's go like for pass yards, they've got Stafford at 224, Jalen Hurts at 197. Like the Hurts one's fascinating to me because you'd think like under based on how they approach things, but I absolutely think there's a chance that the Eagles just pass, like that they're able to take advantage of the secondary for the Rams and do something interesting there. Saquon Barkley, 89.5 rushing yards. Would you pick that?
I would definitely pick that. That would be my number one pick maybe of the whole week.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that one's interesting. Receiving yards. So AJ Brown, who's barely done anything, they have 60.5, which I think is smart. Puka Nacua at 80.5. Devontae Adams at 62.5. Like, I think they're going to put up a lot of receiving yards against this defense, but I don't know, man. That one's a tough one. I don't exactly know what to do there. If we go to the Seahawks, interesting on this one, Jeff, that's not the Seahawks. Here's the Seahawks. You talk about a fun game to watch. By the way, it's so weird that the Eagles and Rams is a 10 a.m. game. Like, usually they save like the big matchups for the afternoon.
Yeah, that was a very surprising.
I'm happy because I get to watch it before the Seahawks game, but that's kind of weird. But the receiving yards for JSN have gone up. Since we looked Wednesday, it was like 60 something. It's now up to 72.5. So I think people are going more on that one. Ken Walker, 76.5. Yet rushing yards has gone up. 220 passing yards. What, Cooper Kupp, 41.5 receiving yards.
I'm not picking Jason Myers.
You're not picking Jason Myers, man.
No.
Any of these numbers jumping out to you? Like,
I still like the JSN number.
You go over on the JSN number.
I would pick JSN over. I don't think the Saints have a great secondary. I think for them to work their offense, they're going to need him. The Walker number is pretty good with Charbonnet doubtful. But I need to see them run block someone else again.
Who do you think they've got? Four guys that could have the first touchdown of the game. Alvin Kamara, Ken Walker, JSN, or Cooper Kupp?
I like Walker.
Walker. All right. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty interesting. And for folks, if you haven't already, Sleeper app is awesome. Make sure you take a chance to download it. Follow all the stats, follow all your teams, your fantasy sports, Major League Baseball. Mariners won last night. Let's go. Let's hope Brian Wu gets some good information on his MRI. And guess what? Use promo code Hawks and you'll get up to $100 match on your first deposit on the Sleeper app. Terms and conditions apply. See Sleeper's terms of use for details. Currently operational in over 25 states. Check out Sleeper today. All right, Jeff, any closing thoughts? We've got this game. We've got the Cardinals game coming up right after. Is there any part of you that's like, man, just get through this game. Don't care if you hold guys out. And then let's focus on the Cardinals. Do you feel like they should be bringing everything they got, like all the injured guys that they can, to play in this game? Like, where are you at on that?
I got a lot of nervous thoughts when I saw Brady talk about the Giants game last year. And it was a game they came off. They actually lost to Detroit the game before, but they played really well and people were kind of hyped about them and they were excited about the offense and they seemed to buy into themselves a little too much. And the Giants kind of punked them, even though it took some fluky plays to stay in that game. I was definitely thinking that a little bit this week, like, oh, they're getting so much like positivity. This team's supposed to suck. They're actually not that bad. So I'm kind of do whatever you can to get a win right now. I think Arizona is going to play a really physical game with San Francisco tomorrow. I think they're going to be in a tougher situation coming out of that game. Their corner group is already ravaged. And Seattle's a more physical team than Arizona. So I think they got to win tomorrow. I think that's a big deal. And it's a game that, again, makes me a little uncomfortable just because everyone thinks they're so bad. We've seen Seattle do this with the Giants last year. it's kind of weird. No one's really talking about like the Clint Kubiak versus New Orleans thing. It's like kind of been unspoken all week.
Because I mean, he's like he was there
not for the revenge game or anything, but he's gonna know that team pretty well.
Yeah,
like that staff should know the Saints personnel. I think that's a kind of an edge. Brandon Staley obviously is gonna know our team pretty well, but Clint Kubiak, he should have a bit of an edge on these guys, how to attack these guys, and maybe they think they know to stop the Kubiak offense. But you're right, it's not like a revenge game. Like it's not like he was going to be the next head coach in Canada. Whenever you hear him do an interview, it's not like that guy screams head coach.
Right.
I do. I'm excited to see it, but yeah, I'm very concerned about overlooking these guys. They have to win tomorrow. I think it sets this next two stretch, if they can win these games, I think it sets up a total different. I think it's a huge, after blowing the first game, I think that Arizona game especially is huge. So I don't think, I really hope they're not overlooking this one.
I hear you, man. I think it's a really, really big 4-5 day stretch here. And if the Seahawks manage to get both games, which honestly, I think they have to. Yeah, I think that they have to for this season to be interesting and go where you hope it goes. You got to get these two games. And yes, one of them's on the road on a Thursday night, which is super tough in any situation, let alone a divisional game. But you're just traveling to Arizona. There's going to be a bunch of Seahawks fans there, including us.
Yeah.
Go get it. Go get it. Like you kind of blew some of your capital by losing at home in the first game in a division. You got to get some of these divisional games, and you just cannot drop games to teams that frankly aren't as good as you. And the Saints, even though they're better than I expected they would be, they're not as good as the Seahawks. You have to win this game.
Yeah, Sando brought up the whole division. It was a really good point. He said, no one's really played anyone yet. I hadn't really thought about that. Pittsburgh's probably the best team that anyone's played in the division so far. And, well, maybe Houston. I don't know what Houston is yet.
I don't know, man. Like, yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Is Houston better than Pittsburgh? I don't know.
I've not been. I do not feel good about what Houston is right now. I love a couple of their defensive players, but team-wise, I hate what they're doing on offense. And it's going to hold back that whole team. So, this is a game they have to win. We've already seen two teams in the division beat them. They need to be the third one. And the Arizona game, again, we're going to learn a lot about them tomorrow when they play San Francisco, because they've had a super light schedule. And it's been, if you've watched them, like it's been pretty gross. And Kyler Murray's been painful to watch. And it's really been their defense that has been more consistent. But now their corners are out. I trust Kyle more than Jonathan Gannon. That's a big game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a really eventful day tomorrow. So with that in mind, make sure you give the show a like and click subscribe. Jeff, man, thanks for coming on as always. I'll see you in a few days.
Yeah, man. Can't wait.
Looking forward to it. All right. That was Jeff Simmons. This has been another Seahawks Saturday. Make sure you go to patreon.com/hawkblogger. Go to HBTix, folks. HBTIX.com. There's hundreds of seats for this game. People are dropping the prices of those seats $100 or more below face value because they want to get them in the hands of a Seahawks fan. Go to hbtix.com, get some seats for this game, go cheer on your Hawks. It's going to be a good time. So I charge no fees. This is just about making sure we protect home field advantage and get Seahawks tickets into the hands of Seahawks fans. And if you want, patreon.com/hawkblogger gets you ad-free audio, gets you access to Discord where we're doing, I mean, honestly, Discord, I was joking with somebody last night. They said the only reason they re-upped their Patreon was because they spend time in the Mariners channel. And it's fun. Like we hang out in there, we talk, we watch the Mariners games together. If you're a Mariners fan, but also other sports, it's a really good crew. So that's a benefit. And you get verified over on HBTix. So people know that you are a Seahawks fan. It's one of the features of that system. So take advantage of it. All right. Have a great day. It is a Apple Cup Saturday for folks that are into that kind of thing. So hopefully that goes the way you want it to. Could be a little ugly for the Cougs, but we'll see. Those rivalry games are always closer than you might think. Until tomorrow, I am Brian Emhauser. This has been your episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings today. Take care.